I think sometimes you can be an ugly American by trying too hard to not be an ugly American. That's like, I've met a lot of Americans who are just like, oh, well, listen to me. Like, I didn't vote for this candidate who's not popular here, and I don't really believe in this. And it's like, well, you're an American who's talking a lot, you know, that even though you're sort of trying not to be the stereotype that you think that the ugly American is, you're still sort of being this noisy, bossy person who's talking more than listening. Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today is my latest vagabonding audio companion episode where I dig deeper into the themes I explored in my books Vagabonding and The Vagabond's Way. In this episode, I talked to David Martinez, who runs the Center for Study Abroad at George Fox, my undergrad alma mater in Oregon. You might recall that I talked with David about how to study abroad even if you aren't a student back in episode 221 of this podcast. Today, we talk about the concept of the ugly American and what characterizes bad travelers. This is actually more complicated than it sounds, since while, of course, we should avoid being rude on the road, sometimes being a bad traveler isn't a matter of bad manners so much as it is being too attached to the habits and assumptions of our own culture and not realizing that cultural differences are as subtle and sometimes hard to recognize as they are intrinsic to the way we all live. We also touch on how technology, and social media technology in particular, can separate us from the place we're visiting, even as it helps us get around and share our experiences. David and I talk about how it's important to get a sense for the cultural values and cultural restrictions of a place before you go there. We talk about the importance of being uncomfortable on the road and how sometimes that means putting your phone down and being vulnerable to a place. We talk about how American consumer culture doesn't always translate to other countries, and how sometimes our attempts to give back to local communities can be misguided if we don't know those communities very well, or if we make things more about our own gestures of generosity than the people we're trying to help. We talk about the importance of not planning each day on the road in too much detail, and how to keep yourself receptive to surprise in the places you visit. We start by talking about flagjacking and how pretending not to be from a place like the United States doesn't necessarily absolve you from being beholden to that place. Let's listen in.
There is a phenomenon when I was traveling Europe many years ago. American travelers from the United States putting Canadian patches on their backpacks. And part of it had to do with this reputation that Americans have. There's this classic ugly American traveler. Have you ever come across this?
Absolutely. Sometimes it's fair and sometimes it's an unfair thing that's leveled at American travelers. And it goes back further than both of our travel careers. It was very big during the Vietnam War, which was an unpopular war. And so, as I was writing my new book, The Vagabond's Way, I realized that there's actually a Wikipedia entry about this. It's called flagjacking.
Flagjacking.
And Americans, awesome. Like, sort of putting Canadian flags on their packs, even though they're not Canadian, is the most obvious examples. But there's other kinds of flagjacking. But it sort of ties into, I guess, Americans have a bad reputation, again, sometimes earned and sometimes not very well earned. And so instead of just being a better American, people are to pretend to be Canadian. And I'm of the opinion, like, just own your actual identity. And if some people are being ugly Americans, because that's a very common phrase, then be a beautiful American. And we can dig into a little bit about why this might be a thing. I think part of the reason why Americans are seen as a little bit more obnoxious than other tourists is America is so big. We can travel for 3 days and never leave the United States. We have less international instincts. We tend to be a little bit loud and pushy. We're sort of a customer culture. And so we can dig into all the iterations of why there are ugly Americans. But don't you have a story from the time you were in Spain?
I do. Yeah, I love the story because it again, we're stereotyping. This is what we always have to say, right? Not all travelers are like this, but there is a reputation. Americans do have a reputation abroad. I talk to students often about this reputation, the different characteristics of this traveler, loud. They often don't make any effort in learning the language. And this is very frustrating as a language instructor. I always encourage anybody who travels to learn a little bit. And there's something stereotypical about the American who's just afraid of trying to speak in a foreign language. I don't know if they're afraid of being made fun of, they're afraid of not getting it right, etc. But yeah, I was about, I don't know, maybe 13, 14 years old. And I was in line, I think it was a McDonald's in Madrid. And at the front of the line, there was this classic older gentleman, you know, with the shorts and the fanny pack and the, you know, the classic touristy shirt. And he was just screaming, yelling at this worker. He didn't speak any Spanish. You know, this is in the 90s. And so fewer people in Spain spoke English. Now it'd be a lot more common to have this worker speak English. But at the time, there was just a language barrier there. And the impression is always, if I speak louder, somehow that's going to break this language barrier. And my father was there, and he went to the front of the line and kind of translated for this gentleman. And I've thought about that often because, again, there's certain things, ways in which you behave abroad. I have a theory about why this has happened or this has occurred. Tell me what you think about this. I think that in the United States, we are a little bit coddled in the sense that, think about a restaurant experience. You go to a restaurant now and you order a steak and they ask you how you want it cooked, what temperature, what cut, what side do you want with it? There's all these options. How much ice do you want in your glass? You know, free refills. Think about when you travel or when you go shopping, the customer's always right. You can return things. My wife still is floored. My wife was born in Spain and she's German. We've been living in the US together for I don't know how long, maybe 10 years or so. And she's still floored by some of these customs, the fact that you can return an item 30 days later. And so when you grow up with this kind of treatment, it can be difficult to go to a foreign country and not get the free refills, not get the ice and the drink, not get to decide how your steak is cooked. And, you know, one of my favorite things to do with students when I take them to Spain is to go to the restaurant and we sit around and I kind of wait to see how they're going to react to the waiter, the server, who doesn't come every 3.5 minutes to make sure your water is refilled, to make sure everything's okay. And always the classic joke at the end when they're done eating, they make this joke every single year and they say, well, I guess they don't want us to pay for the meal because the server isn't coming to give you the check. It's not like in the US where it's like, you gotta hurry up, you know, you gotta hurry up and eat and get out of here so that we can fill the seat, or you also, I'm sure, are very busy, right? So I think that's my theory as to why the ugly American traveler has come to be. What do you think? Am I onto something or no?
Oh, you're definitely onto something. And I think it's tied into the hyper-individualism of American culture, you know, the idea that the customer is always right, or actually the customer should be the expert on how they eat. In France, there's more the métier, the idea that your profession affords you an expertise, which makes sense. And so the French waiter, I know less about Spain, they know, they've been in the kitchen, they know what cuts of meat are good, they know how things are prepared. At the end of the day, they're actually trying to help you because they know exactly what the food is like behind there, and they know what customers have responded to before, even American customers. And so just the idea that this waiter should be this obsequious person who's hovering around keeping your glass full is not a very French way of thinking. In a way, there's more pleasure in asking the waiter, oh, well, what's good today? What do you recommend? And then have him bring it out and leave you alone, you know, for the entirety of your meal. Oftentimes my students, I teach a writing class in Paris every summer, they'll get frustrated because the waiters aren't bringing their bill after 20 minutes. And it's like, I want to experience Paris. I want to go out and see this museum or whatever. And it's like, actually, it's more Parisian to sit for lunch for 3 hours and enjoy your friends and look at the street than to rush off to the 10 points on your bucket list for Paris. And so I think it is a cultural thing. Americans are sort of inculcated. There's advantages to having a consumer culture, but at the end of the day, overseas, you learn a lot about a place by the pace of the restaurant. And actually, oftentimes, the food is pretty good. You know, like when I eat a cherry in Paris in July, I know that those cherries were probably hanging on a tree the week before, not that far from Paris. They weren't shipped in from Chile or wherever it is, you know, when we go to a grocery store in the United States. And so that's part of, I guess, the culture shock of experiencing another place is just knowing that things are done differently in these places. I think tying into something you said earlier, I think sometimes you go to a place like Latin America. Well, we're used to Latin Americans in the service industry in North America, and they've learned enough English to help us. But screaming at somebody in English in Costa Rica is not going to win you any friends or help you be understood. I think oftentimes this is literally a language issue, that it doesn't take that much of language study to create goodwill. My French is terrible. I've been going there for years. But if you just say, bonjour, monsieur, you know, they understand that you didn't say that very fluently, but you're trying, and it's a courtesy. And yeah, you don't just... If somebody in the United States, in New York, came up and screamed in Swahili, where does this bus go? The driver wouldn't have any patience for them. Well, right. Just imagine how ridiculous Americans are, sort of taking the entitlement of customer culture to other countries that don't have it and don't speak the language. And so it's a giant can of worms. And I think for listeners, the idea might just, you know, lead with humility and listen more than assume.
Right.
And be curious. And if you're the only person in the restaurant screaming at the waiter, probably you're the one person who's in the wrong. You know, it's not that hard to look around and see what the cultural norms are.
What are some other ways that we can avoid being this ugly American traveler? We talked about language. We talked about some flexibility, humility.
I think slowing down. I think sometimes that same consumer mindset that makes us think we are entitled to this many refills of our glass of water also makes us think that our travels are of higher quality if we do more. And so when you're rushing to 10 places in a 2-day trip, then you're sort of like a ghost to local people. You're just this person who's trying to tick things off a list, and you're not really listening, and you're not really being that respectful. Not because of bad intentions, but just because you're moving too quickly to really make a genuine connection. So I guess I use 2 days as an example. Stay in one place for 2 days. Yeah. Sit still. Let things happen. See who takes an interest in you. Oftentimes we go to a place and it's like, oh, this person looks interesting because they're wearing what I think a traditional costume is in Argentina or whatever. Oftentimes the person who looks traditionally Argentinian is there in the tourist matrix because... Yes. People are looking for that person. When in fact, the person who approaches you, be it a teenager who wants to practice their English, or an old person who used to be in the Merchant Marines and wants to practice their English, or the middle-aged person who watches American movies and thinks it's cool that there's actually an American there, that's when things get interesting. And that's something you can't plan for. Mm-hmm. And so I think if you can plan, if you can slow down and plan to just give yourself unoccupied time where things can happen to you instead of you trying to force things happening, I think that's when you can move past that ugly American who's in a rush to get this mountaintop experience and not really paying attention.
Yeah, that ties into something I often talk about, which is, and again, we're stereotyping, but there is often a sense that Americans need to be the center of attention. Hmm. And so I often encourage travelers to try to avoid that impulse to come into a restaurant or come into a circle of people and need to be the one who kind of leads everybody or is in charge, or now we're going to go do this, as you say, right? We're going to do this and this and this and that, and we're going to get everything done. If you can try to step out of that role, I think that would also help with this ugly American traveler that we're trying to avoid.
I think sometimes you can be an ugly American by trying too hard to not be an ugly American.
That's
like
true.
I've met a lot of Americans who are just like, oh, well, listen to me. Like, I didn't vote for this candidate who's not popular here, and I don't really believe in this. And it's like, well, you're an American who's talking a lot, you know, that even though you're sort of trying not to be the stereotype that you think the ugly American is, you're still sort of being this noisy, bossy person who's talking more than listening. And at the end of the day, most people probably don't care that much about your politics or what candidates you voted for or what your opinion is about this or that hot button topic, but they would sort of like you to listen to them, you know. Or I think this is one thing that we forget sometimes, especially in the world of social media, which is a whole other can of worms to talk about. Just the idea that we're supposed to have our opinions about everything, when in fact, where's a good place to eat in this town? What do kids do for fun? What do adults do for fun? Is there a church service or a festival, or where's the mosque? Or, I mean, there's just so many quotidian things that structure people's lives in ways that political opinions or broad matters of culture don't. And I think what we share as humans is often that soccer game or that worship service or that interest in art or other things that have nothing to do with what we think defines an uglier American as opposed to a beautiful American. I think just sometimes ingratiating yourselves and having fun, low stakes conversations is part of the fun.
Yeah. You bring up the beautiful American traveler, which I guess you know, you could say is the opposite of everything we've been talking about, learning the language, being humble and so forth. Are there other characteristics of a beautiful American traveler?
Besides going slow and listening, I think, I think learning about cultural norms, because I think culture is often the water we swim in to the extent that it doesn't occur to us that people wouldn't be an individualist. This is something I learned in Korea, that we're so naturally individualistic as Americans that we forget that Koreans sort of see individualism, not just Koreans, but other people in other cultures, they see it as a betrayal of the collective that involves family, that involves community. And once you realize the logic behind that, it makes a lot of sense. But you don't, you can read about it, but experiencing it is something different. And so I think being willing to make mistakes, but not in an obnoxious way, and realize that sometimes your mistakes are going to be against your better intentions. Like once I asked my landlady in Korea, "Nokcha mashile, would you like some tea?" Well, I used the wrong verb ending. We don't have the same verb endings. And so I addressed her like a child, which is very insulting in Korean. And so I made the mistake, and I just rolling with the punches and apologizing and realizing not to do it the next time was part of the process. So I think nobody, and again, social media reinforces this idea that you can be perfect. You can walk in and have all the right phrases and say the right things and get this, the perfect picture against the sunset, when at the end of the day, humans have always made mistakes. And, you know, as long as you're not being a jerk about it, people will forgive you by using, you know, for occasionally using the wrong verb ending, because it's an imperfect world.
Yeah, that takes, and it takes some humility to do that, because you have to put yourself out there, make the mistake, and then have the ability to reflect, to learn, to adapt, right? And to move on.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So I think that being a beautiful American involves occasional mistakes and owning those mistakes and learning from them and really realizing that, that culture is a thing. You know, if you're a woman and you're in Egypt and you, it feels like you're being harassed, maybe it's not because men are horrible, but you're wearing a tank top and Egyptian women don't wear tank tops. And right. The culture that you swim in, you're, it would be like walking around in a bikini, you know, in downtown Portland, Oregon or something. It's like, it's just not done. And so there's a lot of, there's like 10,000 examples like that about how what is seen as normal on the street in the United States is not necessarily normal in other places, including our French restaurant example. You know, it's not a fast churn people out of the restaurant culture. And in a way it's kind of beautiful that you can have a really slow lunch in a place like France or Spain or Italy.
Yeah. I talk about dress code often with my students, and this goes against the stereotype, this ugly American traveler, because often they want to know how they can dress to fit in. And I appreciate that. And I love that sentiment. And so when we go to Spain and they talk about what, you know, what should I wear? What should I not wear? It's not very common for men to wear shorts. And that's often, you know, one of the first things to go, which is they're going to try to wear long pants, but it's hot in the southern part of Spain. And but there's also a sense of, like, as you say, arriving at the country, looking around, observe, see what, you know, see what other people their age are wearing or doing, and you kind of try to follow suit. You're still going to, you're going to be recognized or noticed. You're different. There's a way that you walk. There's a way that you, you know, move your hands and so forth, that you're going to know that you're a foreigner. But there is also an appreciation of an attempt to fit in, which is what we've been talking about from the beginning. And I love that. I love that sentiment. Going back to the comfort, though, there's a great book that I recommend to my students. It's called The Comfort Crisis by Michael Easter. And he talks about this push or this need to be comfortable all of the time. And he talks about how comfort doesn't equal happiness. And so it's a great book full of tons of research and nuggets of knowledge and wisdom. One of the things he talks about is a Japanese concept, misogi, where you're supposed to challenge yourself. You're supposed to try something very difficult, something that you have a 50% chance of failing at, which can be, it can be a little jarring to try something where you might fail. There's a 50% chance that you might fail. The only two rules in a misogi are, number one, it's got to be hard. And number two, don't die. Those are the only two rules. And so I encourage students to read this book before they travel so that they can get into this mode of, I'm going to be uncomfortable. It's possible that I'm going to be in situations or moments in which I'm not going to know exactly how to act. Maybe the bed is uncomfortable. I might not get a free refill. You know, heaven forbid, there's varying degrees of discomfort. But it's also just a good reminder that you can put up with things. You can overcome these difficult, you know, quote unquote, uncomfortable situations. And I think, or part of my goal is that little by little, we're going to change this reputation that Americans have abroad, that over the years, eventually, the ugly American stereotype is going to disappear. I have a lot of faith and hope that could happen.
I do too. And I think often it's not fair. Like sometimes if Americans are noisy, it's because Americans tend to travel in big groups. And if you get a big group of Brazilians or Israelis or other countries, then they're going to be noisy too. Right. And so I think it's often unfair. Like the people who've most readily leveled ugly American stereotypes at me are not the Egyptians or Thais or Namibians that I'm traveling with. It's usually Brits, you know, who like to distinguish themselves from Americans in a moral way. Not to dig on Brits too much, but I got more barbs about being an American, not from the host cultures I was in, but from other travelers who wanted to distinguish themselves as slightly superior because they weren't acting in the same manner as me. I think oftentimes, like, there's a stereotype that Americans are a little boorish and rude, but studies have shown that Americans tip better than your average European does. And often at the end of the day, when the tourists have gone home, it's easy to think, well, this guy said something polite and this guy was not as polite, but this guy tipped me $5 and that is going to feed my family this week. That there's other ways. I'm not saying to throw money at every solution, but I think a lot of stereotypes that are leveled at Americans overlook the fact that Americans can be quite generous and gregarious and fun. And I think, especially as a first-time traveler, just remember to just ease your way into travel and remember that you're not entitled to anything and that it's a privilege to be able to be in another place and to just be a student of the place before you become a swaggering, declarative expert of the place.
Yeah, the tipping culture is interesting because here you do tip, right? 15-20% or beyond. And in Europe, it's not common. You leave a couple of whatever coins you have in your pocket, you just kind of throw. And it's difficult for Americans to do that. They feel in their heart, in their gut, that they are wronging the institution somehow or wronging the server. And it takes a while to get them used to the new tipping. But you're right. The servers and the restaurant owners, they love Americans, especially the new ones who arrive and have no idea the tipping culture.
Yeah, and that reverses. I'm thinking of other cultures that oftentimes, if you have any friends who are a waiter or a waitress, they dread that table of Germans who isn't used to tipping culture yet, or you know whatever European country, and that they think 10% is this grand gesture when in fact. Yeah, some of the biggest tippers I've known in America are people without a lot of money, but they've worked as a wait staff before and they know how much it's appreciated.
Yeah.
So
that reminds me, I was eating at a restaurant in Tennessee somewhere, and my friend's wife is Peruvian and her brother was visiting from Peru. And we're having this nice meal and he wanted to pay for the meal. This was his way of appreciating, saying thank you for hosting me and so forth. I'd like to pay for this meal. I said, sure. Okay, I didn't think anything of it. He pays, we walk out the door, and the server comes running out and throws a handful of change at us. Like launches it at us.
Right.
And, you know, it starts yelling at us, berating us, and the Peruvian is looking around like, what's happening? What is happening? And what had happened is he had tipped 5% or just left a couple of coins.
Yeah.
And the meal was, it was quite expensive. So yeah, you're right. There's this reverse, adapting to culture. But at the same time, I think there were a lot of lessons to be learned in that. The Peruvian could have learned about the culture in the United States. Their server could have recognized that this person was not from this country. There could have been a conversation, right? That didn't happen that way. And those are the stories that then get ingrained in your mind, right? The Peruvians are a certain way. This is my one experience with a Peruvian, and now I believe that all Peruvians are this way or vice versa.
Well, that's why I think instead of flagjacking, just owning your identity and being the best American you can be is good. And just every time I hear a story, I think of something else. Like I know that church tours became popular in Harlem because of the gospel singers and stuff. But then busloads of Germans and French people just sort of sitting in a church as if it's another tourist attraction and sort of not paying the respect that is due a religious service. Well, that becomes stereotyping too. And so I'm sure there's people in Harlem who just are tired of another busload of Germans coming to the gospel service for the music, but they don't necessarily aren't going to respect any spiritual texture of the service. And so I think that the phrase is ugly American and it's ugly American for a reason, but that doesn't absolve any other culture from being insensitive in ways that they might not understand. And tipping is a great example because it's so ingrained in certain, even inequities of how we decide to pay our servers in the United States, that culturally some people just don't understand it. And it's not until they meet, until they get change thrown at them or until they meet a waiter who says, yeah, actually, I paid my way through college because of the generosity of people who were eating meals. And at the end of the day, it didn't cost them that much more, but it meant a lot to me. You know, my wife is an actress and she's waited tables plenty of times, and that those big tips meant a lot to her. And so that is a cross-cultural as much as anything. So I guess we've sort of segued this into from an ugly American to just an ugly traveler thing. Yes. There's different ways to misunderstand a place, often by accident, you know, because oftentimes people aren't trained in American tipping culture, just like they aren't trained to say, look, you know, when you're in a Muslim country, there's very specific things you should do. You should take your shoes off in the mosque, blah, 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 blah. And so I think it is maybe even doing your homework. This is another way to avoid being the ugly American, just knowing what the cultural norms are in a place, knowing what is polite and what is not polite. Gosh, it goes a long way to just have a little bit of knowledge.
Yeah, there too, as you say, there is this reality of an ugly American traveler that exists. And so be aware of that when you travel. You are carrying this burden, quote unquote burden, unfairly or fairly, that doesn't really matter at this point, but it exists and it's there. But it also, as you say, it's any traveler. I talk about this a lot when we go to certain countries where you have to be careful what you wear, you know, like exposing shoulders and so forth. And we get into this conversation about, you know, I'm an independent person. I should be able to wear this without having people gawk at me and so forth. And you know, maybe there's an element of truth to that, but it doesn't take away from a reality of you growing up in a specific culture that allowed you to become this very independent person. And you are entering into a different culture, a different history that hasn't had that. And so I think in that case, within certain boundaries and without getting too political here, you are the one who you have to adapt to that culture, as you say, to, you know, learn about the culture before you go and realize that this is a privilege. And so, I don't know, change a little bit, you know, adjust your wardrobe a little bit, take your shoes off, even if that does make you uncomfortable.
Or respect certain hierarchies that we no longer do in the United States. I mean, oftentimes, you were so individualist that if a kid comes up and asks for candy in a place, you either say yes or no to the kid. You don't ask where the parent is, you know. In so many countries, you don't address a kid as an equal person of agency, that, you know, that basically in certain societies, I'm thinking of Asian ones or maybe even Latin American societies, that it's weird. And this can be, this, there's an economics to this too, you know, that if a kid asks you for a dollar and you give it to him, well, if his dad is working in a mine and a dollar is half a day's wage, then you've sort of broken down the hierarchy and the respect that that person might have for their father. And so again, it's oftentimes by mistake. It's just an assumption that you're, air quotes, helping when in fact, no, actually you threw off the hierarchy of how things work in this village, because a kid for being cute gets a dollar for 5 seconds of his time when his dad is farming all day and is just saving his dollars as much as he can. And so I guess this is the can of worms that intimidate people about travel, because you don't want to do things wrong.
Right.
But I think just sort of going slow and paying attention and adjusting accordingly counts for a lot. You're not going to ruin a village economy by giving a kid a dollar, but it's good to know that you can't do that all the time.
Right, and you can reflect on your actions as well. I think there was one time we were traveling, I don't remember where exactly, but we were handing out candy and the best of intentions. I think it was Ethiopia. Best of intentions, you know, there are kids walking up and we're handing candy. And then we were, towards the end of the trip, somebody said, you know, why are you giving candy? There aren't that many dentists around here. You're ruining their teeth and, you know, and so forth. And like, oh my goodness, we were just trying to make the kid happy, you know? And so I can, there are two choices. One, I can beat myself up and I'm the worst traveler ever and I'm never going to leave ever again because I can never do anything wrong. Or I can learn from that. And then when I was in Burma and Myanmar some years later, we bought some books from a local nonprofit, and during our travels, we stopped at various schools and we're handing out books, and that felt like we're not ruining anybody's teeth at this point, and we're giving them, you know. And I'm sure there's a critique, like, what if they don't know how to read? I mean, there's always going to be some reason not to participate in the culture, but I think the important thing here is to, again, humility, ability to learn and adapt and continue to travel.
Well, actually, I have another example if we have time. Do we have time to,
yeah, of course,
some other examples? Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I'm just thinking about the reason that that travelers give candy to kids is that you get a reaction and they're happy and they love candy. Everybody loves candy. This also happens in volunteer and mission type situations. Well, you'll have a traveler go, and often it's young travelers. You'll teach English for a couple of days in a classroom. You get a bunch of pictures with the kids in the classroom. And then those are the pictures you show to your friends back home. Oh, look at these villagers in Kenya that I taught English. Do you know the name of that kid? You know, do you know what their father does for a living? If this was an orphanage, are you sure they're an orphanage? Because there's actually a volunteerism industrial complex. And their books have been written about this, that it incentivizes people to have the kids looking poor and disadvantaged, because at the end of the day, the person who only has 3 days to spare on their mission trip, they want a picture of a poor looking African, as opposed to spending a year, spending 5 years, actually being trained as a teacher, actually being trained as a doctor and spending time there. And so I think one thing that we should push back against as Americans is that superficial loop. Often it's social media driven now of saying, look at me, I'm a good person, I'm a good Christian, here I am with these poor kids in this country X. When in fact, sometimes you're doing a disservice because you're not really affecting any change at all. It's about you, you know? Yeah. Oftentimes on volunteer mission trips, it's about the story that we tell about ourselves when we come home, as opposed to the long-term longevity, 6 months, 6 years, 60 years of this community. How are you giving back to that? And so it popped in my head when you're talking about candy, because there's a million ways that good intentions can yield mediocre to bad results, particularly if part of your motivation is to be seen as a good person who is getting a smile from a kid, when in fact, it's much more complicated everywhere in the world.
Part of the way you can get away from this ugly American, as we're talking about the stereotype, is to carve out some space to let the trip happen to you. You often say that, right? Let the trip happen to you. And that can be a little bit, it can be difficult because you need to fill up your time. This is the time I have. I need to do everything, as opposed to here's a day where I have nothing to do. So yeah. I'm going to walk around the street. I'm going to go to a cafe. I'm going to sit there for more than 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Heaven forbid. And just see who comes in and see what conversations I can strike up.
Yeah. Let your day breathe. I think these days, more so than ever, we really owe it to ourselves to plan some unstructured time in a foreign place, because we can overplan our lives. You know, there's an app for everything now. Yeah. And in a way, ideas of time efficiency sometimes rob us of our time wealth. And time wealth is a phrase I use a lot. You know, just the idea that the days that you're given in life are the wealth that you have. And a lot of materially rich people have unhappy lives because they haven't thought about how to spend their time. And so sometimes if we overplan that day on the other side of the world, we're robbing ourselves of the very cool experience of sitting at the edge of the village square with our coffee and just sort of watching the day play out, or going through a walk through a neighborhood that we're not necessarily familiar with. And if we get lost, we'll just ask the guy, you know, pardon me, do you speak a little bit of English? This is where I'm staying. How do I get back there? And those open the doors to a place that no amount of planning and no app that anyone will ever design can, because it's how humans have always related to each other. Yeah. And humans are pretty good to each other at the end of the day. There's a few hustlers who are out there who want the money in your pocket, but at the end of the day, especially ironically enough, outside of tourist zones, people are really curious about who you might be.
I was on a trip leading students. We started in Italy, went to Slovenia, and ended in Croatia. But while we were in Italy, northern Italy, we were in the Dolomites, and we were doing this hike, just a couple of us. I think there were maybe six or seven of the students and myself. And we came upon a group of Spaniards. There were about, I would say 15, 18 Spaniards. And I speak Spanish. I'm from Spain. So I started talking to them. Hey, what's going on? How, you know, what are you up? What are you doing here? And they said, oh, we came here because there's this picture you can take. Check it out. And they showed me there's an influencer with this pose, you know, with this like waterfall in the background, or I forget exactly what it was. And I said, oh, wow, that looks really beautiful. And he said, don't worry, don't bother going because it's, you know, it's the wrong season. There's too much snow and it looks awful. So don't even bother. I mean, it's just up the road here, but you shouldn't even go. And that got me thinking a little bit about this, you know, this kind of newer thing. I'm a bit older, but this idea of influencers, of taking pictures, and not just now taking pictures, but now we're going to follow these influencers around to these different places to get the exact same picture. And I can't help but be a little bit sad about that. It seems to take away a little bit of the adventure or the kind of finding those spots on your own, even though maybe in my age, I guess when I was young, like the similar kind of thing would have happened. I would have seen a picture in National Geographic, or I would have seen a picture in some magazine and be like, I need to go see that place in person. But I don't know. I'm a little bit conflicted with this sort of social media influencer, Instagram kind of way of traveling.
Yeah, well, it feels really new to guys like you and me, but it's been happening in little chunks for centuries. The idea of the picturesque, the idea that we should travel to see things, of all of our five senses, seeing things is important, goes back to before cameras. An Anglican minister called Gilpin, I think, in the UK, wrote about how important the visual sense is. And he sort of wrote this manifesto for how we should collect pictures as travelers. This was back in the Romantic era, around the time of Wordsworth and other famous poets. Well, within a few decades, the camera had been invented, and suddenly you could literally fix these pictures. And so I think this is part of a conversation that goes back to there, where we're sort of favoring our visual sense. We're isolating our visual sense instead of using all five senses in a place. And in a way, we're erasing those places. Like the Spaniards you met are saying, yeah, don't go there. It's not worth it. When in fact, well, what are you going to smell, hear, or taste up there too, right? We've had a version of this conversation before. I talk about hiking with my wife in Colorado, and like we're in a pretty isolated part of Colorado, and this woman and her husband are like brushing their hair for like 10 minutes. Like they're basically primping, and that like all of these amazing things are happening in Colorado, but they're basically preparing for a photo shoot. And this happens more and more often, that we have isolated through services like Instagram, which I enjoy as much as anybody else, we have isolated the visual sense as the most important part of travel, and also this sort of fake idea of perfection. Mm-hmm. That the big cliche is that you have 200 influencers standing in line on a beach or a cliff to take a picture that makes it seem like they're the only person there. And that actually we're having less enjoyable experiences of travel, even as our photos show us having this amazing time, because we're performing a version of travel for people who aren't even there. And so the sad part of this, I think, is that instead of enjoying a time in a place in its all five senses with the people we're with, we're sort of trying to harvest, air quotes, likes from people we don't know and may never know, by being more impressive than the other people who come to this place and have also taken this picture. We're sort of in this hermeneutic loop where we go to the place because of a picture, and then we take a picture that we try to make as much as possible like the picture that brought us there, forgetting that there's all these other amazing things that are way more affecting than the picture itself.
It's funny because you and I both, we didn't grow up with cell phones, right? And so we learned, you know, and maybe at the beginning it was a little bit different, but now it's an extension of who we are. Would you ever travel with? I mean, would you ever go to a foreign country without a phone? Is that something you would consider as kind of an experiment, as it were, and then write about it?
Right. Well, it's funny that's a stunt now. To travel right. Without a smartphone is this crazy stunt that you can do to write about. Actually, when I went with my wife to Paris last summer, we didn't get data plans. And so we could use it on Wi-Fi at our Airbnb. But when we were out in the streets, we could use our phones as cameras, but not to use for other sorts of information.
This was intentional?
It was intentional, yeah. Yeah, we just decided not to get that as a data plan. And so what we did is, she's a big foodie, so she would find the restaurants that she was curious about and mark them in pencil on our paper map. And so part of the fun for us, we're having these adventures where we were disconnected and we had our paper map and we would use it around and we would get nominally lost, not dangerously lost. But part of the fun was not just that our mission was planned around a paper map with a few dots on it, but there were no distractions. There was no buddy texting this or no temptation while we were waiting in line for this museum or this restaurant to see what was happening on Instagram or something like that. And so that was a fun little exercise that was really rewarding. We didn't miss that phone at all. I mean, there's some situations I was teaching a class, like students may have had questions that I wasn't able to answer for several hours. But at the end of the day, that's tough luck. We were having a good time. We were enjoying a distraction. And this ties into work life too, is that used to be a big separation between work and not work. Well, now when your boss can text you at 9 at night and say, oh, by the way, then it really, we allow this to not set boundaries on how we live. And your Cuba story reminded me of a Cuba story of my own at the time. This was before smartphones. But my Cuban friends, we would go out, and just as an American, I always had more money than them. So I sort of insisted that I was going to buy dinner or drinks in this situation. And finally, my friend Marcel said, stop. Just stop throwing money at the night, and let's just be Cubans for tonight. And so my Cuban friends were very well educated, but didn't have much money. But they could milk. I don't know how many times we stayed up till 3, 4, 5 in the morning, not spending money, walking around, having conversations, maybe pooling what money we could scrape together. They wouldn't let me pay more than my share to get a little bit of food or something to drink. And that, as a constraint, was part of the joy of that exercise. Just like the constraint with my wife in Paris of not having an active cell phone for anything besides photos, it made things interesting. And so I think sometimes so many problems can be solved by a thing like a phone that we realize that the constraint of certain problems makes your day more interesting. And so just like we had a blast, we didn't stay up till 5 in the morning in Havana arbitrarily. Yeah. We were doing it because with very little money, we were having a great time. And of course, Cubans stay outside and stay up late in a way that maybe other cultures don't. But I love that. And so I think maybe for people who are digital natives and don't have the perspective of not really ever not having a smartphone, find a way to play games with it, you know, do a stunt, you know, just maybe it can be a show-offy thing in its own way. It's like, yeah, we're going to spend the next 4 hours with no data from our phone at all. We're going to walk around. We're going to walk until our day becomes interesting. And that can be a blast. And that can be rewarding in a way that you need not throw your phone away, but you can put it away for a while and see what happens. And if it's the worst experience of your life, which it probably won't be, it's probably going to be fine, then you can use your phone all the time anyway. But it's so not necessary. Humans have been traveling for millennia without smartphones. and it's been fine.
There's a great book called The Shallows by Nicholas Carr, published some 10 years ago or so. And he talks about the internet. We see the internet as this, you know, all these as a tool, as a way to do things, but really the internet is a source of distraction. And I think that has helped me understand, as we're talking about boundaries and balance, that yeah, the internet can do a lot of things, but if you see it also as a source of distraction, maybe it becomes a little bit easier to let go of that source of distraction, particularly when you travel, because I think you are going to miss out on a lot of things. If you're always like looking to fill your time, you know, and be distracted as you travel, because that's not, presumably you didn't travel to do the same things you're doing back at home. So yeah, I like that.
I think a good metaphor here is smell, which is the slowest scent. There's a Swiss Korean philosopher called Byung-Chul Han who wrote a book called The Scent of Time. He's basically saying it's not the number of experiences that make life meaningful, but it's the duration of those experiences, which is sort of an abstract way of basically saying that, like, you can't replicate smell through your smartphone. You have to wait for smell. You can't rush through a bunch of different smells. And like, I'm sure some people are maybe listening to this podcast on double speed. You can speed up sound.
Or take away the spaces in between, right? Or you can, yeah.
Right, yeah. And actually, like, the metaphor for a smartphone, you're sweeping through, you're going through Instagram one after another, beautiful photos that generations ago people never saw in their lifetime, and you're just flicking through them. You can't do that with smell. So I think if you use smell as a metaphor for what you might be missing if you're rushing too much, then that can make you more present in a place and make you realize that it's more than just that photo or that noise or whatever is going on, that you have these other senses that can deepen your life. And again, Americans, we're a culture where rich people will eat standing up because it's more efficient.
Yes.
And barely taste their food, whereas people in poor countries will spend a lot of time with their families, which rich people often don't have a lot of family time, slowly cooking a meal, what they can afford, and eating it together in ways that we forget that that form of wealth is something that we ignore now.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including links to my books Vagabonding and The Vagabond's Way, as well as the George Fox Talks podcast, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.